Now, we've taken the whole matter back to the Supreme Court on a petition for review from that order. But the point that I'm trying to make is that if someone is going to be excused on the grounds of insanity, I think that it only makes sense that the burden of proof be on him by simply a preponderance of the evidence to establish that he is insane, so that when you come out of the case, you know for sure that his insanity has been established and you're not in a never-never land where nothing has been proved other than that you don't know what he is beyond a reasonable doubt.
What does Barry say to that argument?
Well, Senator, this is a very difficult one, because when the commission considered this, the only reason the commission considered this at all was to bring the insanity test into Title 11, moving out of Title 12. We brought up the issue, should we consider looking at it at all, were there any problems with it? The commission, I believe with the exception of Mr. Hickey and perhaps representative of the Department of Public Safety, felt that there were no specific problems and should not be looked at. I consider the insanity test probably, from what I understand, probably one of the most difficult areas in the criminal law. And whereas I don't necessarily have any problems with what Mr. Hickey is arguing, I do have some difficulties about making an amendment such as important as this one, simply based on the testimony of Dan. 28 states, I believe, do it the way Alaska does it. One of the concerns about the criminal code revision is causing fundamental changes. I think that this would be one of the most fundamental changes that could be caused.
Okay, let's glide over that, but both of you earmark it.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that one, aren't
we? We're coming back to everything.
Yeah, well, the rest of that, because I like an either or. I like a guy to be black or white.
Should I move on?
Yeah.
On the culpability provisions, which go from page 92 to essentially 94, we set out the requirements of culpability for each offense. And under subsection B, you must prove that a person acted with a culpable mental state with respect to each element of the offense that necessarily requires a culpable mental state. Mr. Edwards had some problem with that language, necessarily requires a culpable mental state, and I believe it could be improved. I'll try to do that. We say that you don't have to prove culpability for things that are violations, which would be just punishable by fine, or offenses that are strict liability. Subsection 2 says you don't have to prove culpability if an intent to dispense with the requirement clearly appears. For example, in statutory rape of a person under 13, you don't have to prove that the person knew the victim was under 13. Section 610 on line 18, on page 92, says that if you have one culpable mental state term in the statute, for example, knowingly applies to each element of the offense, for example, know that the result occurred, know the circumstances exist. Subsection B sets out the general rules of culpability in terms of what culpable mental states apply to each element in the code if you don't necessarily specify it. Conduct is knowingly, and a circumstance or result is recklessly. Subsection C states the principle that if you establish a higher form of culpability, for example, intentionally, that is required by, we have four terms that are used: intentional, knowing, reckless, criminal negligence. Intentional being the highest term, criminal negligence being the lowest. The statute requires a reckless standard, and you establish the higher one, intentional or knowing, you've established a culpability requirement. Basically restates the obvious. Page 93 states that ignorance of the law is no excuse. On subsection A. Subsection B provides when a mistaken belief of fact negates criminal liability. And there are three circumstances. The first is when it negates the culpable mental state. For example, theft requires an intent to deprive someone of property. If you pick up a raincoat, for example, in a store thinking it's yours, you didn't have that intent. Don't establish one of the elements because you thought it was your property. Subsection 2 says that a provision of law can specifically provide that a mistake is a defense. right now, I don't recall one in the code where we do that. Subsection 3 says, if the factual mistake supports a defensive justification, that's sufficient. For example, under the code, a peace officer is justified in using deadly force in making an arrest of a person he believes has committed a violent felony, reasonably believes. It turns out that the person did not commit a violent felony, but the mistake was reasonable, the person still has a defense. Page 93 is the intoxication provision of the code, and of all the revised codes I'm aware of, it's the most limited. It says that intoxication is not a defense to a criminal charge unless it negates an element of the offense that requires an intent to achieve a specific result, for example, intent to cause death. That is existing law, but it's much stricter than the proposal recommended by the subcommittee. It's about as strict as you can get as to intoxication.
You're going to have to get that one strict to get it past the government.
Well, it's very strict. Lines 2 and 3 on page 94 are very important. They say that the provisions on culpability only apply to the provisions in Title 11. In other words, if you have a crime that's defined outside Title 11, these general rules don't apply. The reason is it could create havoc if it applied to other statutes. And frankly, we learn from the experience of another state. In Oregon, for example, these general rules applied to all crimes, regardless of whether it was in the criminal code. And you basically had a reversal because of an unintended result like that. We learned from that. Now, on page 94, we list the four culpable mental state terms and we define them. And again, the four terms are intentional, knowing, reckless, and criminal negligence. I think it's important to stress these sections and how important they are. And I certainly agree with Mr. Edwards. They're one of the most important sections of the code. The subcommission, in reviewing the criminal law, found that the area of mental states in existing law is a mess. There are 26 terms that are used to express culpability. For example, maliciously and wantonly, maliciously or wantonly, maliciously, wantonly, and negligently, for example. Well, there's nothing wrong with that if that doesn't affect the administration of justice. But there have been two recent Supreme Court cases where statutes have been thrown out, where you've had an appeal and a conviction has been reversed simply because the statute did not specify culpability. And under the code, that's basically going to be impossible because we have general rules of culpability and the four terms are set out. And these terms are common to probably 30 of the 34 revised criminal codes. I think they're tight, and I think that they will be understandable to the jury. On page 95, we have approximately 10 pages of definitions. I'm sure Mr. Hickey and I, in terms of going through the bill, will come up with some technical amendments to them. Some have been suggested already by Jim McKenzie and actually Kent Edwards. There is just a couple I'd like to point out that immediately stand out. On page 98, line 3, we define firearm. And Mr. Edwards pointed out quite correctly that while we eliminated the loaded-unloaded distinction, we seem to say it has to be capable of causing death or serious physical injury. That was an unintended result that was very easy to take care of. We will. On page 102, we define the term threat, and that definition goes on for approximately 1.5 pages. Mr. Edwards raised a point about that, and I think it's completely valid. We're going to be working, Dan and I will be working on redefining the term threat. On page 104, we have the a provision of the code on line 17, essentially the last provision of the criminal code before we get to sentencing. This deals with the problem of spousal abuse or family violence.
Okay, which page now?
Yes, page 104, line 18. And this deals with the situation of when you can arrest for misdemeanors committed outside your presence. Under existing law, you can only arrest for misdemeanor. A police officer can only arrest for a misdemeanor committed in his presence. One of the problems that was brought to the attention of the subcommission was the area of spouse abuse, family violence. This section allows a peace officer to arrest for a misdemeanor assault when it involves people in the same household. We define how household as the social unit of those comprised, the social unit comprised of those living together in the same dwelling. So it allows for official intervention when you have essentially a wife beating case that didn't take place in the officer's presence. I consider it really important.
But I think you're getting that into an area that you and Senator Tillion a little bit of problem.
If injury has resulted, obvious injury that I can see.
Well, okay, let's qualify it that way, because otherwise the husband and the wife have sent the kids out to the movies and they're sitting there at the kitchen table with a yellow pad hacking things up and they get into a brawl, verbal brawl.
Yeah.
But she just calls the officers and says, come on out here, arrest this bastard. He's been beating me.
No, you must, for me to be able to swallow it, she has to be able to show physical injury.
As drafted,
like a blackened eye or a loosened tooth or a bloody nose or something like that.
As drafted, it only applies to assault in the third degree, and that is defined, I believe, in two ways. One way does not require actual injury. It only requires putting the person in fear of injury. You would want this to only apply to the provisions resulting in injury?
Yes, because the thing is that then you have the one-on-one proof of, did he really threaten me?
What you're trying to do is write a recodification or a revision of a criminal code. You aren't trying to throw the domestic relations court in this state into a complete turmoil, which is exactly what this will do as written.
No, but if you can, you know, if you can show me where she's been actually injured and you can, you know, a doctor can say, yes, you know, this isn't an old wound, it's a new one.
Let's say he or she.
Well, I can say he or she occasionally. You find some poor little guy that gets slapped around. Or stabbed.
This provision was added, this was not in the subcommission's original proposal, it was added in-house.
Well, I don't think it's going to injure it enough as long as the injury has to be shown. I should use the word he in this case, it covers both.
Dan, I went.
The purpose of the section, as I understand it, is to take care of situations where a spouse is too afraid to sign a citizen's arrest.
I see what it is.
And even the situation where, as Senator Zager describes it, they're sitting there, you know, divvying things up on a yellow pad and get into a verbal dispute, and one spouse calls the police. Technically, if that spouse is prepared to sign a citizen's arrest, that person can be taken into custody right now as it is. And there are circumstances where, in fact, we're prosecuting a homicide case right now in Fairbanks, where the police responded to a call of spouse abuse. They arrested the person. The wife was willing to sign a complaint. She didn't want to initially, as I understand it. She begged the police officers, don't let this man outside. Don't let him out. He'll kill me. And they took him, they booked him. He bailed out an hour later. They called me guilty. That's sort of what the section's all about. It removes the onus from the complaining spouse to sign that citizen's arrest and cause the other spouse to be put in jail, and puts the onus on the police.
And I understand, you know, I've no cases where a fella has sat with a loaded gun, you know, cocking it and uncocking it, deciding in his mind while he drank whether to kill her or whether not to, and she's a bowl of jelly when it's all over. But on the other hand, to cover the other abuse he's talking about, there has to be injury.
It's a delicate problem to request.
It's not that, you know.
Well, it's subject to such great abuse, that's the problem.
You just can't allow the abuse, even though there might be an abuse on the other side.
I'd like to have $5 for every call that I received, especially when I was more active in Dom Rel work, from a wife saying, he's out in the bars and I know he's going to come home. I'm afraid that we're going to get into it again tonight. What do I do? And I said, call your friendly cops or have your neighbors alerted so they rip a window shade away. They'll call for you. But under this, you wouldn't have to do anything.
No, I can't. I can't see. You'll have closed. You'll have reached 2/3 of the way. By allowing
I have no problem with that suggestion.
Okay, fine. Let's not talk it over any further.
Dan, did I pass over anything that you thought was a substantive problem?
The only thing would be that that section on value and age.
I think we can cover work.
Okay.
Get to sentencing now, and rather than go through it section by section, right. I'd like to just start with what I consider the most important portion of the bill, and that's simply presumptive sentencing. I think that most of the introductory material needs to be reworked in terms of drafting.
What are the Kent Edwards type remarks in this one?
Right. Well, Kent was that specific is the sentencing stuff, but just in terms of, I guess we've got to establish the basics. I know Dan has a number of suggestions which change the basics. So
okay,
the first thing we have to consider is that in every the subcommittee's proposal, the House Judiciary Committee's proposal, gives a judge total discretion as to first-time felon offenders. But there is no presumptive sentencing. 22.5 to 7.3. Dan, do you have any problem with that, or you can offer?
That's not entirely correct.
Okay, I'd like to consider that.
That's almost a separate, stands out by itself. Because that's an extra 3 years, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 3 year minimum. I would like to consider that as part of presumptive sentencing. But in terms of, with that exception, with the exception of first degree murder, second degree murder, and kidnapping in the first degree, you don't have presumptive sentencing at first. That's the first thing I guess you have to, either, you know, give me some feedback on whether you want to stay like that.
I had urged this is really a fundamental question, and I had urged the House Judiciary Committee to adopt a comprehensive presumptive sentencing scheme that included all felony offenses.
Even the first offense?
Even the first offense, but to treat it, you know, differently in certain respects. One of the problems that you've got is that if you look, for example, at the resolution that Mike referred to that addresses itself to first offenders and urges the court system to adopt a system of guidelines, you'll see that really every whereas clause in there represents an individual specific justification why first offenders should be included. It's the best justification, the best argument for it. The problem is this, is that by not including first offenders, what the House Judiciary Committee did was they changed what was our original approach, and when I say our, I mean the administration's bill last year, which defined somebody as a second-time offender if he had been, as Mike pointed out, convicted of the same or more serious class of felony. They have now said that someone is a second offender if he's been convicted of any felony as a result of deleting first offenders. This was sort of a compromise.
I disagree completely with that. I don't think that issue had anything to do with the other issue.
Sure it was, because the point that was made was that if you exclude first offenders under the more restrictive definition, you are excluding around 80% at least of all felony offenders from the provisions of the bill. Okay, because first offenders defined as someone who has not been convicted of the same or more serious class of felony represents at least 80 and maybe as high as 90% of all felony offenders.
But you still go before the judge.
You still go
sentencing
before the judge.
By a judge. And I'm just not up that tight about it.
Okay.
What I really want is the recidivist.
Right, but here's what this whole thing has led to. It's led to a situation, for example, with a first class A felon, where a person convicted of rape can get, in the discretion of the judge, up to 22.5 years. Okay? If he's got a prior rape, the sentencing judge himself
could give him no more than 15 years, and we would have to demonstrate that extraordinary circumstances were present and get the case to a three-judge panel in order for the sentence, in order for a sentence to be imposed on a second offender as serious as what can be imposed originally on a first offender.
Which conceivably could be, but logically I think you make sense, but practically do you?
That's the judgment of the people in our offices that I've referred the bill to on this issue. I think so. I think it's particularly true in those kinds of offenses.
Well, the thing is that you can do a Myatt tuning for it if you want to by giving the judge a little bit more discretion, allowing him a little higher, if that'll solve that problem.
That's an alternative
when it
approach.
Should really change the thing.
Well, let me point out something. This number here used to be 15 until about a day before the bill went to a floor vote. It was increased to 22 and a half years simply because of basically complaints by law enforcement that we weren't treating aid felons the high, you know, seriously enough for the first offense. So the committee decided that when you're dealing with a violent crime like an aid felony, the judge should have total discretion on the first offense to go as high as the maximum sentence.
Then give him at least that discretion on the second offense, no problem.
Well, if you're doing, okay.
No, you can't do that because then you're getting away from presumptive sentencing.
You still keep the presumptive on the lower end.
You wouldn't be, Senator, if you required that for the judge to do that, he must first find, by clear and convincing evidence, that it is an aggravated case, that he first find an aggravating factor, in which case he could aggravate it from the presumptive term up to the statutory maximum. Well, I guess the alternative that I would propose is that the internal ceiling on second and third offenders, which are the more serious offenders, under the concept of aggravation, be removed, and the judge have available to him the range of discretion between the presumptive sentence, in the case of the second A, that would be 10, between 10 if you stuck with those numbers, to 22, instead of from 10 to 15.
Well, the problem with that, though, is you're getting away from the entire concept of presumptive sentence.
That's fine. I go for Terry on this. I can see Dan's fear, but I don't think it's a very real fear.
I don't think it's a very real fear either, but the thing is that it will endanger us in that if you did have it from 10 to 22 and a half, where you have 22 and a half for the first offense, I don't see where it would damage the law. And so therefore, I'd say it would shut up a lot of police without endangering the code.
Yes, but there was nothing in Mr. Edwards' critique as to this point. There was nothing in there that talked as
I know, but that's not going to be the last critique. They're going to wait until we turn this one out, and then they'll critique it again.
Mr. Hickey's proposal changes the concept of presumptive sentencing in the sense that you will now have an aggravation factor of about 100% in terms of aggravation, but a mitigation factor of 50%. And I think that's...
I'm kind of between you two fellows. I want to bring something out. You know, I think your logic is correct. No argument on that. I just think that you can't have something that somebody can mathematically prove that you could get a lower maximum on a second offense than a first offense.
No, it's not true, though. That is not true, Senator. You will still be able to get the highest maximum on the second offense in order. The only reason Mr. Hickey has a point now is because the committee decided that for first offender you should go as high 22 and a half years from 15 as it used to be. Now I would propose that if Mr. Hickey is concerned with logic here, that we reduce this 22 and a half back to 15, and that argument will not be
Barry.
That really raises a different issue because the B's and C's have a different statutory maximum penalty available for a first offense than they do for second or third offenses. And that really redefines the crime in a certain sense. And it was a compromise. I suggested to the House that they make the statutory maximum available, in other words, in the worst case, have that penalty there so it can be used across the board. And they basically went along with me on A's and they cut it down the middle. They went with A's and they didn't go with B's and C's.
Well, I don't necessarily have too many problems. I mean, I'd have to think about that, but the idea of making B 10 on the first and C...
No, it would have to be 15 and 6.
Well, I mean...
Those are the statutory maximum.
I don't know how
the senators would react to that, but I think that that is a more realistic way to deal with it than...
It'd be much nicer if you two guys could come to some accommodation. The only thing is that I know how Senator Ziegler's going to be on first-time offenses. You're not going to get a mandatory on a first offense, and I tend to agree with him.
I didn't mean to propose that there would be a mandatory, okay, that it would have the effect of being a mandatory minimum on the first offense. Even if you included a presumptive sentencing scheme, it could be presumptive sentencing. And the proposal I originally submitted to the House was a presumptive sentencing scheme, including first offenders, where mitigation could go all the way to zero, in other words, to a suspended sentence, i.e. no mandatory minimum.
And people cannot accept it.
That's true. It's a difficult concept.
When you present that, the presumptive sentence for an offense could be probation, it gets people upset. The idea of saying you're presumed to be sentenced to probation is an upset. It just throws people.
That wasn't part of the proposal here.
For mitigation, say.
In the mitigated case. But the difficulty is that the principles are going to be applied. And whether the legislature likes it or not, what's going to happen is that an individual judge is going to figure out what the legislature would have done for first offenders if it had included them, based on what it had done for everyone else, which means that you're going to have, in effect, the potential for 23 or so individual presumptive sentencing schemes for first offenders running around the state. And make no mistake about it, the fact that you affected second and third offenders will have a direct effect. What's done there will have a direct effect on what happens with first offenders.
Right. Yeah, I don't see the problem.
That's right. Well, the problem is there's no way of predicting what that's going to be, and no way of predicting.
It won't be heavier than the second offense. It'll be from somewhere between there and zero. What's the panic? I fail to see that as a panic.
Well, I suggest for the time being we sort of glide right past this point with the suggestion, perhaps, if you two can get a mutuality of. Doesn't sound very likely from where I sit, but Tim is right. I'm not going to go for mandatory imprisonment on first sentences.
Senator, I assume that means any type of presumptive sentencing scheme for first offenders.
Well, what I think you've got in here is all right with me for the time being, at least till I really look at it a lot harder than I have.
Then I've got to ask the next question, and this is something I brought up with Mike. How do you get into the second and third class? Is any felony sufficient, or should it be the same or more serious class?
I'm willing to spread it to a felony.
To any felony.
In other words,
should this. If you committed a C your first time, and then you committed an A.
But C can be fairly serious crimes.
Well, it could be fairly serious, and it could be not too serious, too. So I think that is, considering Mike's comments, I think that is a fundamental question.
How does Dan feel about that?
Well, the issue ties in with the other issue.
Well, then back to the drawing board. Isn't a certain kind of theft a Class C felony?
That's correct.
Okay.
Over $500.
All right. And then a man sustained a conviction of this type 6 years ago, and then he gets knocked up. I mean, he gets hauled in on a rape charge and convicted.
Yeah. Or manslaughter would be a better example.
Manslaughter, fine, as you will.
And the problem is that you could have that $500, say, better yet, a $500 shoplifting situation.
Okay.
And then you have a drunk driving conviction, and your presumptive sentence is 10 years. Now, you could go as low as 5 with the mitigation. Now, it could be said that that's exactly what an extraordinary circumstance is.
With your case, I don't mind a drunk driver getting 5 for manslaughter.
Well, I'm just giving you giving you the potential problem there. And I'm also saying that there may be a built-in mechanism there by the extraordinary circumstance.
Would you say this was changed in the final moment?
No, this was not changed in the final moments. It was the thing that I referred to that was changed in the final moments was upping this penalty from 15 to 22 and a half. The idea of changing the any prior felony was made,
No, I wouldn't even mind the 22 and a half at 15 if it was something that wouldn't cause us the loss of it on the floor. But I don't. I just think it would cause us nothing but heartburn on the floor.
But I'm not arguing below that 15. But I was just bringing up that what's the problem.
As long as the judge has the right to go from there all the way down to zero. By the time a guy is served, yeah, I don't see the problem. Go ahead.
I think we have a feeling for what you had in mind.
Okay. Then the next question that comes up is, what do we, are we going to stay with our proposal regarding mandatory sentencing for murder one, murder two, serious kidnapping, and first offense of firearms? The situation is that the way we drafted this, if you're convicted of first degree murder, you must serve 20 years in jail. You're not eligible for parole until
that one. That was the McVeigh bill, wasn't it? Yeah, that was the McVeigh bill. It's fairly stiff, but of course you don't charge it with murder one if they have some extenuating.
Well, murder two would be 5 to 99, kidnapping. The problem, I guess. Here's where I get to my problem. I think that maybe Dan and I both agree on this one, at least. If we have this special provision that says you committed a first offense A with a firearm, you must serve 3 years, mandatory sentence. Now, there may in fact be an extraordinary circumstance where we just don't want to give the 3 year sentence, because we've already said that there may be an extraordinary circumstance for the A felon, where we don't want to.
Yeah, but a firearm.
Okay, but the thing is, why not subject this to a three-judge panel? In other words, we've subjected all presumptive sentencing to a three-judge panel. Why not also say that if manifest injustice would result from a three-year sentence, it could be mitigated by the panel? And an A felony could be something like manslaughter, and manslaughter is an A felony, and it could involve some kind of hunting type of accident, or Representative Dankworth, who proposed the amendment, had some second thoughts about it when he considered various ways that manslaughter could be committed. Another approach that we could do is redefine the eight felonies. In other words, exclude manslaughter and just include things like forcible sexual assault.
It would be easier to go for your three-judge panel.
Well, I can buy it if I have to. I'd prefer to go actually to the one. The thing is that if you've got a gun in your pocket when you've done any of these things that require intent.
Well, they don't necessarily, though. You see,
well, rape requires some intent,
But not manslaughter, for example.
That's right. You can have manslaughter when you're drunk behind the wheel with no intent.
Right.
So I could see screening that out. But burglary with a gun in your back pocket?
That's why I was saying the second approach would be to redefine the eight felonies, make them more limited.
Well, I'll have to strike a deal with Zig on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I hate to let a rapist or a burglar lose some for a three.
I guess I'm good. Okay, the other thing is we've eliminated parole for second and third time felons. And I consider people have been glossing over that. Mike did a fairly good job of glossing over it. I consider that a really important change. I mean, in the sense that under existing law, a third-time felon would be eligible for parole after a third of his sentence would be served. Under the code, he is not eligible for parole. He must serve the maximum.
But he gets good time.
He gets good time at a rate of 1 to 3. That is correct.
Oh, that's not bad.
I agree.
Okay.
Let me throw something at the committee. What would the committee think of eliminating parole altogether, eliminating the parole board? Over a period of about a three-year period where everyone.
I've never been in favor of the parole board.
Well, if it's going to be phased out, would it have to be done in this bill?
It it wouldn't have to be done, but no. This would be an appropriate place to deal with it.
Yeah, it would, but as Clem points out, as the politician, this has to come out. We're talking about a problem in terms of saleability. And we have our share of bleeding hearts in that Senate who would say, I'm not ever going to vote for a bill where we don't have any parole boards. You know, I know that. Like, what are the little changes we made for doing away with parole?
A little, you know, I'm willing to give it a try, though, because I've hated the parole system.
I mean, the point Senator Ziegler broke up just brought up about the separate bill approach. It just seems to me it's just a really important issue, and to try to put it in.
Look, if he says he won't buy it, there's no sense in me pushing it.
No, I'm not saying I won't buy it. I'm just saying I don't think it's a very sellable idea.
Well, it's not the thing is that I wouldn't mind putting it in the first version and giving it up in free conference.
The point being, I have figured out a constitutional way to do it. And an extremely fair way to do it, where people, even where they're sentenced discretionary as a first offender, they're given full good time provisions, and they still would be released on supervision as if on parole, but there's just no longer a discretionary release when the judge gives a sentence. That's what the sentence is. It's calculated. The guy knows what he's going to get. He knows if he behaves, he can earn a certain amount of good time, and he's released then under supervision for the duration of his term. That would be what it's all on.
Okay, move on.
I can finish up probably 5 minutes.
All right.
The next question is, are we keeping the three-judge panel? The three-judge panel was in the governor's bill. It's been in every presumptive sentencing bill that I've seen. I don't know. I don't think Mr. Hickey has a problem with the three-judge panel. But Mr. Edwards did raise it, and I consider it a fundamental question now that it's been raised. And I
will let you and he argue about that.
I'm not upset about it.
We have to be guided by counsel.
You know, I prefer a three-judge panel than a jury, if you really kind of like that.
Yeah, I don't have myself. I don't have any problems with that. There's one, I think I've covered the major issues. There's one minor issue about probation revocation that Mr. Edwards did bring up, and I think he raises what I probably think is a legitimate concern on his part, and that's on page 110 of the bill. And I think Dan should carry this one.
It's the one I think it is. It's the one I've been raising for
it is
a year and a half.
I gave you a chance to win all day.
The present statutes on probation revocation make it absolutely clear, and Supreme Court cases following have made it absolutely clear, that probation revocation is in the nature of a civil proceeding. Okay, that someone has already been convicted, having been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he's been sentenced. Put on probation by a judge subject to certain conditions. You will not drink, for example. You will not violate rules established by a probation officer for reporting.
What you want is preponderance of the evidence rather than clear and convincing evidence.
I wanted to simply go back to the existing law. There was a debate in the commission.
Go back.
Cut down a little.
Go back.
You're not
going to
have any problem.
Dan, if I missed anything that you think are major that should be brought up,
I think the rest of them are pretty technical.
I think
the main thing was getting a feel from the committee for the direction.
I'd like to sit down and talk with Hussein when we get the thing all compiled about what's so revolutionary about this thing. That's where I had my problem.
Well, classification of felonies for presumptive sentencing. Not necessarily revolutionary, but it's kind of new to Alaska.
Oh, you bet, yeah.
But I think this, I can't, of course, call a meeting. I have no way of knowing what Senator Holman contemplates doing in terms of committee meetings. And
excuse me, there was one thing that I spoke with Senator Hackney in the Senate Health and Social Services Committee about his proposed Senate Bill 551, which would require a judge to sentence a person to alcohol education or rehabilitation if the offense arose or somehow connected with alcohol.
assign somebody to an alcohol.
The problem with that, and the problem with the bill that Senator Sackett introduced along the same lines, was simply that the court will say in his sentence reporting, whatever you call that, commitment of judgment, whatever the hell it is, and he's heard all the posts, I mean,